Good morning. First case on docket this morning is ETT Inc. versus Delgado. Counsel, for the record.
Good morning, Chief Justice Douglas, and may it please the court. Dan Polsenberg for ETT.
Just a reminder this morning, an order was previously issued by the court. The parties are directed to limit their argument to the issue of whether the district court erred by excluding Russell Foster's audio tape and his deposition as a discovery sanction in the context of punitive damages.
Thank you, Your Honor. And this petition for rehearing does present that singular issue. There were three bases that plaintiffs argued for punitive damages in the district court. One was that Mr. Dierenpin, the facilities manager for Terrible Herbst, acted with malice in allowing temporary employees to drive on March 16, 2001. One was Mr. Dierenpin ignored Terrible Herbst's own policies. And the third was that there was some corporate cover-up and destruction of evidence. As to all of these, the deposition of Russell Foster was critical, especially with the real issue, the malice. There were only three witnesses who could tell whether or not Jeff Dierenpin allowed the temporary employees to drive on that fateful day. One was Mr. Dierenpin. He said he didn't allow them to drive when he was out of town. One was Ray Ellison, the driver who was drunk and killed Rose Delgado. And he said he was allowed to drive the vehicle if they needed pallets. And the other person who, faced with those two, just that evidence, the jury was free to pick either version. But there was another person there, and that was the other temporary employee. And Russell Foster testified that, no, they were not allowed to drive that day, that the orders were explicit, that the only thing they could do was work at the warehouse, that they decided on their own to go for a joyride, and that when they did, they went out and got drunk and killed plaintiff's decedent. So that information is critical. Now, why did Judge Gonzalez exclude that evidence? Judge Gonzalez excluded that evidence because in the middle of trial on January 6th, on a Friday, plaintiffs were asking Mr. Hanna, the security supervisor for the Terrible Herbst entities, going through a list on a document and saying, well, what about this audio tape? Did you produce this audio tape? In front of the jury, they say, well, where is this audio tape? We send the jury out in the hallway for an hour, and we fight about things. And the next day, Saturday, trial counsel, Mr. Parnell, finds the video or the audio tape. It was very easy to find. Justice Ada asked me during the panel argument, exactly how did this happen? There was an envelope of material sent to trial counsel from Terrible Herbst. They took out of the envelope all the documents, and there was an audio tape down at the bottom they didn't notice. That Saturday, Mr. Parnell transcribed the phone message left by Mr. Foster that said essentially the same thing, that we did something we weren't supposed to do. It's not Terrible Herbst's fault. Judge Gonzalez excluded the audio tape and excluded the deposition. I think both are error. Clearly, the deposition is error, excluding the deposition, because there was no reason to do that. There was no willful conduct on the part of trial counsel. There was no prejudice involved. And we've argued that a higher standard applies when you're dealing with punitive damages. If this had just been a compensatory damage case, the court would give deference to Judge Gonzalez's determination. But Your Honor.
I was just going to ask you, how do you actually get to the issue the evidence was excluded by the judge in the liability compensatory damage portion where the jury also determined that there was going to be a punitive damage hearing.
Yes.
How do we get to the issue now that it's been the law of the case that it's been excluded in the liability portion?
Well, law of the case doctrine never binds this court. This court determines what the law is. The law of the case applies when this court has decided something and remanded it to the district court. The way
it would be easier for us if we were looking at the whole case. In other words, the liability portion, the compensatory damage portion, the punitive. But we're only looking at the punitive damage portion. So how do we get to tee up, as Justice Mappa would say, how do we get to tee up the issue here when we're limited as to what you're to argue?
I think we're actually in an easier position here, because in my petition for rehearing en banc, I dismissed all my arguments about compensatory damages. I think the difficulty comes in, really, when you're looking at a situation, how do you decide what evidence comes in for compensatory damages and what evidence comes in for punitive damages when they are both being tried at the same time, as this case was? The second phase in this case, what I always call the penalty phase, was simply to determine the amount of punitive damages. Here, this court is in a position to remand for a trial just on punitive damages.
Could the judge have allowed it, excluded it in the liability portion and then allowed it in the punitive damage portion?
No. And not in this case, and I would submit generally it would present a problem as well.
So is this case limited to its procedural posture and its facts? Because the rule you're advocating that would have a stricter scrutiny applied to exclusionary rules that are sanctions-based, that would only come up in this kind of a case where it's on appeal and you're evaluating only the punitive damage phase of it. How would this judge have tried this case if we're going to make a general rule that generally applies that says if you're going to impose sanctions that affect the liability determination, you have to tread more cautiously when you're in the arena of punitive damages? The statute draws the line at liability damages, not
yes.
punitive damage liability in the death penalty phase.
Well, let me address, that raises a number of issues. I do agree that this case is easier because all I'm asking for is a new trial on punitive damages.
The liability and the amount both.
Yes. And
in which case, let me just interrupt because it trails the two questions that have been asked.
You bet.
In which case, this is not, if you will, an opinion-worthy disposition because it is limited to its own facts and the procedural posture of this case. What Justice Pickering is asking, and I believe what Justice Cherry is asking, is the same question that the entire court has.
I know, and it's something I've struggled with for years. I've been in the situation much more frequently in federal court, where the issue on appeal is whether there should be a new trial on punitive damages. And I've represented plaintiffs in that situation asking for a trial on punitive damages. I think there are several ways to handle this. You know, at one point I said to Judge Gonzalez, you might as well, if you're not going to let me have Russell Foster's deposition, you might as well strike my answer. If Judge Gonzalez had stricken my answer, we would be in the position where we could do what Judge Lohrer did in Goodyear and Vahina, where you go in, tell the jury that that liability is imposed. They simply determine the amount of compensatory damages. And then in another phase, they address the issue of whether there is malice or not. And then the other case from last year, Foster versus Dingwall, according to a footnote in that opinion, the respondent actually conceded punitive damages. So it is available option that this court could strike the punitive damage award. The question that I have, Justice Sata, is how do you handle it in the regular case? In Exxon Valdez, the Ninth Circuit talks about trifurcation, and I have argued trifurcation in front of District Judge Hardesty in the Fenfen cases, but that's almost an entirely opposite situation. That's where you have a phase on compensatory damages, liability and damages, a middle phase on liability for punitive damages, and a third phase on the amount of punitive damages. But that's the situation where the court has inculpatory evidence against the defendant, which is so inflammatory it would affect the determination of liability of the amount of compensatory damages. This is the opposite. This is where there's exculpatory evidence. Here are two pieces of evidence that should come into evidence, at least on punitive damages, that show that the defendant didn't do something wrong. Now, how does a jury... My focus on this is geared toward the eight people who make the civil decision. How does a jury, faced with that situation, say, look, all of a sudden we're getting more evidence that shows that the defendant here wasn't liable? And that's a difficult situation. I don't think we can shake the jury.
Mr. Pulsenberg, I know it's been kind of categorized as possibly exculpatory, but if my recollection is correct, both parties were drinking in this van, not just the driver,
yes,
but both parties.
I'm
so
not...
the jury could have looked at it either way possibly, but we do have a factual issue of he made this statement, and I'm wondering how the jury might have even perceived that statement by him.
Both of the temporary employees, we're not talking about whether any of them were exculpated by this evidence. We're talking about whether Mr. Dearman was. Here is a
statement where you're attempting to offer.
Yes. Well, it would be free for the jury to give it whatever weight the jury wants to give it. But here is the third party in the conversation who says Mr. Dearman is correct, that he did not let us drive the truck. That goes to his malice. It also goes to, on the issue of punitive damages, whether there should be punitive damages imposed. Because remember, their argument was that here is Dearman refusing to follow Terrible Herbst's own policies. Well, here's proof that he was following the policies, which goes to
was there sufficient evidence without this for the jury to make a decision that they did?
I don't think there was. And I argued the 50A motion. And I thought that even with what the driver, Mr. Ellison, was saying, I didn't think there was a punitive damage case. But I'm not arguing that in front of this court today. What I'm arguing is with a case that close that I think we would prevail as a matter of law, this information on punitive damages would have to come in. Let me just take 8 seconds to discuss the tape. The reason I think the tape should come in is because it was tried in front of the jury that we had this tape and where is it? Oh my goodness. If it weren't for that, I think Judge Gonzalez would be absolutely fine in excluding a tape that we didn't produce. I do think that it goes too far to exclude the deposition. But under the circumstances, the tape should have come in as well, whether it was an issue, whether we were lying, covering up, and fabricating evidence. I'd like to save the balance of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Philip John. I represent Labor Express. I'm here simply to ensure that nothing related to the district court's ruling to dismiss Labor Express comes up. It appears it has not. And if you have no further questions, I will not take any more of your time. Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice, members of the court. My name is Robert Eglett. I have the privilege of representing the respondents in this matter. The first issue I want to talk about, which I feel is the elephant in the room that's not being discussed, is the fact that AT&T did not properly preserve their new constitutional argument, and they may not raise this issue for the first time in their petition for en banc reconsideration. The constitutional issue was not properly preserved, as the cases cited by AT&T in this petition for rehearing were never previously cited in any previous brief. NRAP 40AC provides in pertinent part that the matters presented in the briefs and oral arguments may not be re-argued in the petition and no point may be raised for the first time. And this court in Stanfield versus State stated that this court denied the rehearing where the case law that supported respondents' argument that the court's analysis of equal protection was incorrect was not cited by respondent in earlier briefs. In denying respondents' petition, this court in Stanfield stated that because respondents failed to previously cite to the specific case they now rely upon in their petition for rehearing, the issue was not properly made in the first instance and the court could not consider it on rehearing. The court reiterated these same rules in Lane in 1988 and in Chowdhury in 1995. In their petition in banc, the appellants in this case, for the first time, cite to two North Carolina cases, the Hunter and the Decker cases, which is the substance of their appeal, the basis that there should be a higher standard. First of all, there was no reference in the trial, or on this issue was not preserved by Mr. Polzenberg or the trial counsel at trial at any time after the sanction was made or at the close of the compensatory part of the case before the punitive damages occurred. Mr. Polzenberg nor anybody else said, Your Honor, now that we're going into the punitive phase, we think that we ought to be able to put the Foster deposition. They were never prevented from putting any evidence in this case below. So it wasn't preserved. The objection wasn't preserved below. And then the initial appeal on this case,
The only mention of this is two sentences starting on line 10 of page 61 of their opening brief, where they simply make the statement that this may be affect our due process rights, not allowing the Foster deposition in. No citations, no cases cited, no authority whatsoever. It's not a proper, it does not preserve this issue.
Mr. Eagle, what happened at the trial in the punitive phase when Mr. Bolzenberg made the comment that this Foster deposition should come in? Did you object? Did Judge Gonzalez
That's my point. He never requested at the punitive phase that the Foster deposition came in. In fact, the defense offered no evidence in the punitive phase of this case, with the exception Mr. Bolzenberg offered a Q2 form for a different Herps corporation to try to show that they had a loss, which the court wouldn't allow. So they did. They weren't prevented from offering any evidence in this case. So they didn't.
I was going to say, aside from the constitutional issue that you're claiming wasn't raised, what about the issue of the excluded evidence? Is that before us, really?
No, I don't think it is. I think the only issue before this court is whether there should be, as I read their brief, whether there should be a heightened scrutiny when it's a punitive damages case. And let me point out that the two cases they cite, it's very important, the two cases they cite, they rely upon from North Carolina. First of all, North Carolina law does not have a heightened scrutiny for the appellate courts to look at the trial court's decision when it is a case-concluding sanction, when the default judgment has been entered. There is no heightened scrutiny. They simply use the abuse of discretion. In those cases, those only two cases, one case citing the other case, they use the heightened scrutiny only in a case-concluding sanction when there is a punitive damage phase to the case. That is not the situation here. These were not case-concluding sanctions. I requested case-concluding sanctions at the trial. This was not the first sanction. This is not the first sanctional action we had. First of all, we had destruction of evidence of a videotape which showed the drivers going in drunk into the lot that day with a security guard letting them in and then getting in the trunk of the same security guard, opening all these gates and letting them out, and 3 minutes of it were destroyed. And the court gave, over my objection, I requested the answer be struck, but she gave the lesser included instruction of a rebuttable presumption. She even gave them a rebuttable presumption. But the presumption was that the evidence that was on the videotape would be against them. Well, what was the evidence that would have been on the videotape that the jury presumed? That these guys were intoxicated. Mr. Ellison had a .3, three times the legal rate when he was arrested, would have showed that they were drunk. The security guard should have known they were drunk. They were allowed to go in, so obviously had permission to use this truck when Mr. Dearman wasn't around, and then let these two gentlemen out. So that was the evidence and the presumption, and they presented nothing to rebut that presumption at trial, other than
they
Mr.
They were hamstrung by virtue of her exclusionary ruling, which is to say Mr. Foster's testimony was excluded. The problem I have with this case is its procedural posture, but put that to one side. At trial, the district court judge said this audio tape was not produced, therefore I'm excluding the audio tape and I'm excluding this witness's testimony in its entirety.
Deposition. The witness wasn't available. It was simply a deposition.
Same difference.
Right. Yes.
The evidence he had to bring to the jury was excluded. Once that happens, and you have clear and convincing evidence standard by law on the punitive damage phase, you're sending someone into battle with an arm tied behind their back as a sanction. And the issue I have with this case is what prejudice was caused to the plaintiff by virtue of the untimely production of the audio tape?
Well, Your Honor, because we did not have the audio tape available to prepare for the deposition of this gentleman, this other drunk cohort of Mr. Ellison. We didn't have the audio tape that he come in and made this some sort of frantic phone call. We didn't have the opportunity to listen to it, to cross-examine him on whatever it is he said in this audio tape, the manner in which he said it, to have an expert analyze it, to possibly say, does he seem excited, does he seem pressed. We didn't have the opportunity to cross-examine him to see if anybody had talked to him before he made this this phone call. So absolutely we were prejudiced. We didn't have the ability to challenge the information in that audio tape, and then all he did was parrot the information back
in
his deposition.
You did attend his deposition.
We didn't know about it.
You attended his deposition.
I didn't personally, Your Honor, but my co-counsel
did. I'm not talking about you personally,
yes.
But counsel for the plaintiff attended this
yes.
gentleman's deposition. And as I read the record, but I'm not clear on this, the judge found no willfulness in the non-production of this tape. Is that right?
Well, what happened was Mr. Trial Counsel went back over the weekend after this issue came up and searched through his file, which he'd had for years and years, and came back and he said it was misplaced in a file. I didn't know it was there. You know, we found the audio tape, and so. Based on representation of trial counsel for the defense at that time, the court found that it wasn't willful, but nevertheless it didn't make a difference because it still prejudiced the plaintiff's opportunity to appropriately prepare and cross-examine this witness.
And who raised the issue of the missing audio tape?
Well, it came up during the cross-examination during the examination by my co-counsel of this witness. He's the fact that the audio tape.
So the witness volunteered it?
In response to a question on direct, yes.
But was he asked on direct, was there an audio tape?
I think you took him on direct, and that's when it came out, was that there was an audio tape. So, and you know, the defense claimed, well, there was this memo that should have put you on notice. This memo didn't put anybody on notice about this audio tape. It was such an innocuous little statement. So it was a complete surprise to everyone in the courtroom, Your Honor.
Thank you.
So my point is they never raised this issue except for these two lines in their opening brief. In their petition for rehearing before the Northern panel, they never even discussed this issue at all, this due process constitutional issue. For the first time, it's in the petition for rehearing en banc that they raise and brief this issue properly and cite to these two cases from North Carolina that they now rely on. Now, putting aside for the fact that these cases are completely distinguishable and don't apply in this situation, that just like in Stanfill, this court should refuse to consider these cases and any argument concerning them, as AT&T's citation to these cases in this petition is inconsistent with NRA or a P40AC. Now, it's very important that the court understand that these two North Carolina cases that they rely on for this heightened standard, in those cases, the sanctions, the discovery sanctions, were case-concluding sanctions. It was, the answer was struck, and they were prove-up hearings. That's all it was. The defense counsel was not permitted to present any evidence, was not even permitted to cross-examine witnesses in those cases, was not permitted to put on any defense. So under those circumstances, those are the situation where the appellate court the intermediate level appellate court in North Carolina says, well, when there's punitive damages involved, we have to let them defend themselves on these punitive damages. These defendants had every opportunity to defend themselves in here. None of the sanctions by Judge Gonzalez were case concluding. I asked for them, but didn't receive any case concluding sanctions, and she always gave the lesser included sanctions. And these were, you know, escalating problems. You had the videotape, you had some other issues, and then in 2 weeks into trial, all of a sudden we have this audio tape come up. Even with the videotape, she gave them a rebuttable presumption in which they couldn't rebut. So these cases do not apply to the factual situation we have in this case, where in this jurisdiction, this court has already determined that under case concluding sanctions, that the court is going to use a higher scrutiny, a higher standard to determine that. These were clearly not case-concluding sanctions in this case, and the defense had every opportunity to defend themselves in this case, Your Honor.
Mr. Eagle, let me ask you this question. If, let's say for the sake of argument, we disagreed with you and said that they did preserve the right to raise this issue in the petition for en banc reconsideration, would it be appropriate to remand us for a new punitive damage hearing where the jury would be entitled to hear this deposition testimony and the audio tape?
No, Your Honor, it would not.
Because and tell me why.
That sanction was part of the entire case. And that to suggest that, you know, the punitive damages case hung on this one issue of whether they had permission to use this truck is simply not true. It's not true. There was overwhelming evidence of other issues that were clearly supported of the punitive damages claim. First of all, Mr. Dearman admitted that he smelled alcohol on Mr. Ellison's breath on numerous occasions while he was employed and continued to keep him employed as a temporary employee. Specifically asked for him by name from this temp agency, and Mr. Ellison, he admitted, had asked him if he could drink on the job on the lunch hour, and they continued, Mr. Dearman continued to keep employment. And probably the most important thing supporting these punitive damages argument is that this company, Mr. Dearman, the temp agency they went through, had two different level of prices, hourly prices for these temp employees. One was a pennies higher per hour because those were people who would be qualified to drive the trucks. The other ones were not. No driving. And they didn't do the background checks and didn't do the driver checks on those people. They purposely hired the lesser penny per hour employees where the temp agency didn't do the background check, didn't check their driving record, and then still instructed those people to drive. So to save pennies, they didn't know anything about it. And Mr. Foster actually offered, not Mr. Foster, Mr. Ellison actually offered to give his driving record, and Mr. Dearman says, I don't need to look at it.
Well, doesn't that just make this evidence even more important because Foster in his deposition in the tape says he wasn't authorized to drive?
No, not Ellison is what he's talking about.
Right.
Ellison says he was authorized to drive, not Foster.
Okay.
So I misspoke, and I apologize. Just briefly, to wrap up, I do want to point out, if I could just have a moment.
Go ahead and make
thank
it
you, Your Honor. I want to talk about the practical, what practically will happen here if this court orders a new trial on the punitive damages. AT&T has already tried to get AT&T has filed bankruptcy. And they have already tried to get the punitive damages portion of this case dismissed by the bankruptcy court.
Is this part of the record?
I don't know if it's part of the record or not, Your Honor. But I think it's important for the court to understand.
Let's keep this
control. The bankruptcy stay is reflected in this court's pleadings, although not in the appellants.
Well, we brought this back before the court to deal with the discrete issue of whether this should be allowed in the punitive damages phase. So let's not go into this other issue as to what might or might not happen because of the bankruptcy proceedings.
All right. Just to wrap up then, Your Honor, we invest in our trial judges the discretion to preside over trials appropriately with an even hand. It's exactly what Judge Gonzalez did here. She followed the case law. She analyzed the situation. She gave the lesser included sanctions, and it was appropriate in this case. I think it would have been appropriate for her to strike the answer in this particular case, but she didn't. So there's no reason for a heightened scrutiny in this particular situation. And let me point out that the actual punitive damage judgment or verdict in this case was $10 million. And Judge Gonzalez reduced that by $5.8 million to $4.2 million already, Your Honor. Thank you.
Madam Clerk, if you'd give Mr. Reyes 3:32, give him an even 5 minutes. And out of the box, Mr. Pulsenberg, I guess one of the questions Mr. Eglert has put forth that this wasn't properly preserved, and additionally, there was no request in the punitive phase to offer into evidence this issue.
Well, let me address your second point first, because I think I can do that quickly. The penalty phase here was simply to determine the amount of punitive damages. It wasn't to determine whether there was malice. That had already been determined in the first phase. While I've always argued that punitive second phase is a penalty phase, I think even the criminal lawyers among us will agree that the penalty phase is to offer mitigating circumstances, not to offer exculpatory circumstances. You don't, in the penalty phase, come in and say, oh, you were wrong in the first phase. I really am not guilty. Here's new evidence that the judge didn't let in. I think that's, and that's what I was talking about in my main argument when I was saying it would shake the confidence of the jury in the entire judicial process if they were to hear new evidence in the penalty phase that undercut their entire determination in the first phase. And I think that goes to Justice Sata's question. How do we handle this? Is this opinion worthy? I'm sure my client, in this case, doesn't really care if you publish an opinion. Although, how does it affect the law overall? I think if you're going to try punitive damages and compensatory damages together in the first phase, as was done here, you have to consider all the evidence in light of the punitive damages. So you would have to use the higher standard in determining whether a sanction is going to exclude critical evidence. And here this was all sprung, to use the phrase that we use repeatedly in our briefs, during trial. So it was not a situation where before trials in the Fen-Fen cases we could ask for three phases. We were already well into this trial when this issue came up, which is why I moved for a mistrial.
Could you address the first question that Justice Douglas asked? Because Mr. Eglin has a point about whether this was adequately preserved.
Well, it was. In their answer to our petition for rehearing en banc, the only argument they make is that we never raised this before on appeal. And notice now, Mr. Eglin, who didn't write the answer, says, oh, yeah, we did raise it, but we raised it on page 61. Now, admittedly, these briefs are too long. But, yes, the heading on page 61, heading C, says the exclusion of the Foster deposition and its effect on punitive damages. Subheading 1, the exclusion of the exculpatory evidence denied due process. That's in our opening brief. On page 15, heading 1A also argues, in that section, also argues that the exclusion of this evidence was particularly effective on the punitive damage claim. Now, I've argued throughout, and if you've ever handled one of these cases, you understand the competing interests. It probably was a case we should have, an appeal we probably should have brought in the first place, only arguing punitive damages. But because of certain reasons, we had to raise all the issues.
And
so it was
not,
raised.
You did not raise any authority, notwithstanding the mention that you've just cited to us from the record. There was no authority supporting, legal authority supporting your position. Would that be a fair
statement?
Except
perhaps the due process clause of the 14th Amendment. But
understanding that.
I'm not sure I need those two North Carolina cases. And I'll tell you, I'm really stretching to have to rely on those cases. But this issue so seldom comes up. Because it is rare that a district judge will make a ruling like that. Look at the two cases I brought up from last year. In both of those, Judge Lohrer was able to protect Goodyear's due process interest by allowing a full trial on punitive damages. And in the other case, I conceded the punitive damages were no good because of procedural due process issues. So the penalty phase, I don't think you can come in and say we should have brought it in the penalty phase. It doesn't fit in the penalty phase, where we're only talking about mitigating the amount of punitive damages. A lot of Mr. Eglin's argument about why there's other evidence really does go to compensatory damages. And they have a fine section in their answering brief about how even Mr. Foster's brief shows the negligence claim against us. But they don't show malice. And they don't show that Dearman was ignoring their own, Terrible Herp's own policies in allowing him to drive. In fact, they show that on that day there was no permission to drive when they were unsupervised. This is a difficult...
Mr. Polsenberg?
Yes, Your Honor.
Two questions. Is the review of punitive damages by this court de novo? And secondly, where there is a constitutional challenge to punitive damages, should this court conduct such a challenge sui sponte?
Clearly de novo. The United States Supreme Court has explained that when you're dealing with punitive damages, in Honda versus Oberg, the court even used the phrase, the usual hands-off deference. This is the United States Supreme Court. To district court determinations does not apply when you deal with punitive damages. So I think you're dealing with, you're not looking at an abuse of discretion. It's a much more rigid standard than that. I don't know if there's a standard between abuse of discretion and de novo. And absent that, I think you would have to do de novo. Sua sponte, I think if the issue, I have raised this issue. I think if the issue weren't raised, punitive damages are such a terrible force. I think there is a point at which the court could and perhaps should raise an issue sua sponte, because the issues in this case are so critical. Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice.
Thank you.
Mr. Chief Justice, in fairness, I would like to ask the court permission to let Mr. Eglett respond to my two questions.
Mr. Eglett, and Mr. Polsenberg, I'll give you probably 2 minutes, depending on what's stated.
I disagree, obviously, with Mr. Polsenberg, not the first time. But no, I don't, Your Honor. I think it is, I'm not saying punitive damages are not important issues, but I do believe that it is incumbent upon counsel like Mr. Polsenberg and myself, although I came into this trial a couple of days after it started, who have been involved as appellate counsel, and I refer to us sometimes as trial consultants for other lawyers. They have us come and babysit them through trial. No offense, guys. But I do believe it's incumbent upon the counsel to make the record, to make the objections, to raise these issues in their opening briefs. And while both sections of where Mr. Polsenberg says, well, what we did say it on page 61 and we did say it on page 15, they're one sentence and two sentences, and they do not cite any authority whatsoever.
Do you make of the citation to Campbell and BMW versus Gore? I mean, they're really asserting that due process requires active review judicially at the appellate level of punitive damages, and he does tie those cases in his brief.
But the specific issue they raise here in Bonk, which this argument is limited to, is the issues they raised in the two North Carolina cases, Your Honor, which is, should there be a heightened scrutiny under a situation where punitive damages are affected when there are sanctions? And my point is, North Carolina, unlike Nevada, doesn't have a heightened scrutiny when it's a case concluding sanction. And so under the circumstances in North Carolina, they said, well, these are case-concluding sanctions, and therefore, since punitive damages are arise, we need to have a higher scrutiny on these type of cases. This court already has a higher scrutiny on case-concluding sanctions. These were not case-concluding sanctions. Those cases simply do not apply. Thank you.
Mr. Polsenberg.
Thank you, Your Honor. You're most gracious. Let me just explain my answer. When Justice Hardesty asked about whether this court should address things sua sponte, I took that literally, albeit in Latin. This court has consistently held that the court can address constitutional issues raised for the first time on appeal. Justice Hardesty's question is, should the court address them sua sponte without them being raised by any party? I think there are situations where the court can address them sua sponte. It's not an issue in this case because I have raised them. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. This court would thank counsel for both sides and all counsel who participated for this thought-provoking issue. And again, we go down another path of something that has not been decided before in the state of Nevada. With that.